Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. The simplest way that one of the simplest ways that the Buddha would state his teaching, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. And I think that's helpful to keep in mind. But the Buddha's realization of the end of suffering was obviously more profound than just a happy sunny day. There was something quite deep and profound about his realization, but he chose to teach not so much to talk about that realization, although he did, but to speak more about what prevents that realization for all of us. And then the signs of that are when we're conflicted in some way, when we're suffering in some way, and suffering can be just a minor annoyance to terror. There's a whole range of things that contract us and restrict us from that realization. And the path of inquiry that we use, the path of contemplation, is a willingness to go into those contractions, to go into the various kinds of suffering we experience as human beings, and just to observe and see how are they caused, how do they arise, and how do they cease. And this takes an attitude of inner vigilance, some analysis, but more an attitude of just, like Ajahn Sumedho would say, standing under or understanding, standing under some conflict that's going on, internally, externally, and having the forbearance, the faith, I suppose, also the faith just to attend to it, to give it attention, to observe it. And then quite often from that kind of attentiveness, insight arises when we begin to see how it works. I was speaking to someone the other day in Ottawa who has done a lot of spiritual work. Their view, their understanding, and their faith was a faith which are based on that if any kind of emotion arises in consciousness, it needs to be expressed. And so I didn't know this person very well, but I was just kind of talking and talking, and I said, "Well, what about indulgence? Is that a part of your vocabulary?" And the person had not really thought about that, because they had taken the position that if anything comes up, any kind of negative emotion, childhood feeling, whatever, it needs to be expressed. And then they always expressed it. And so, as we were saying, I said, well, if you express it, don't you just end up reinforcing it? Don't you just make that the pathway of consciousness? The person really, really hadn't thought of that so much. Because in their worldview, repression was a very strong word. You shouldn't repress. But they hadn't considered, well, should you indulge? And what about restraint? Where is restraint in all of this? Is restraint a part of your vocabulary? So we had a good talk around that. But what is important in there for us, I think, is that if we have a wrong perspective, or what we call wrong view, or wrong understanding, even if we're sincere, we might make very diligent efforts and be very sincere in our efforts, but if the understanding is wrong, then the result won't be good, because it won't be according to nature, it won't be according to how nature works and where peace lies and what are the causes and conditions for peace. So in Buddhism, we really emphasize right understanding or right view. And that's not a matter of belief. It's a matter of, the example I always like to give, it's like the law of gravity. You know the law of gravity, so you know it's so implicit in your body that when you go on a roof, you know you have to be very, very careful because the law of gravity rules. If you're not careful, you slide down and hit the ground. So that's right understanding, but it's an understanding which is in your bones and your cells and your all through you. It's not simply a doctrine which some chap, Newton or someone, invented and then you believe in. And so right understanding matures through study, but matures very deeply through attentiveness, through the power we have to observe cause and effect. And when we really notice that when we do something, we get a negative result, and we actually see that happening in consciousness, that's Dharma. And then we are informed in a way, we come to view in a way which is beyond mere belief. It's a part, becomes the implicit part of the way we understand our life. And then from that understanding, we make decisions. And those decisions that we make, the determinations that we make, then will govern the results that we get. So you can see how when the text they say that right view is paramount, right understanding is paramount, but not as simply as a grasping of position, as an attachment to position. So if like I think I was talking about the Xin Xin Ming, you've heard that poem, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences, and it goes on, right? That's a fantastic poem, and there's more in it from one of the Zen patriarchs. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. If I grasp that viewpoint that I shouldn't have preferences, then I'm just grasping an idea, and then I struggle with myself. I wanted a coffee, not tea. Maybe I'm not a Buddhist, and I get all conflicted because it's not really Dharma. It's not something I've understood and reflected upon. It's simply a position I've grasped. And then I try to impose I try to live my life through this imposed structure. And my life becomes very, very dogmatic, maybe, or whatever, in a very unskillful way. And yet taking on something like that and reflecting on, what would that mean? What would preferences mean? And watching how I prefer something and I don't get it, it's not a problem. I prefer something and I don't get it, and it is a problem. Oh, that's suffering. Well, why is it suffering? Well, it's suffering because I can't let go of that preference. Oh. So it's the inquiry into suffering, into the contractions of the heart, the attentiveness to that, not in a way of blaming, but just noticing that you get an understanding of what suffering is, what its causes, and what the end is. And this is a path of inner inquiry, of inner vigilance, inner honesty, these kinds of things. So the teacher is this contraction that we feel in various kinds of ways, the conflicts that we feel internally. Now what is very helpful in that kind of inquiry is if we don't feel contracted. You know, if at times our hearts are at ease, if we are connected to life in a way which is wholesome and skillful, because if we have that sense of ease and openness and balance, then when contraction takes place, or suffering takes place, it becomes more apparent. We have contrast. I like the idea of contrast. If I've experienced in my life some sense of collectedness, say, I suggested that would be a way of talking about meditation today. So I get an idea that what does it mean to be collected, and I ponder that, and I do that, and I train with that, and I do that for 45 minutes, and I get a sense of that. Yeah, this is when the mind is collected and at ease, even if the meditation it wasn't something I want to write home about. You know, the mind was a bit whatever, but still I get a sense of this is collectedness. Then when I go out into the marketplace and the mind gets scattered by by fear or worry or annoyance or whatever, I have this way of noticing it more clearly. I have some contrast. Because why? Because my mind has some strength in it, and that's the strength of samadhi or collectedness, a strength of mind which helps me to notice suffering. So not only is there's the right understanding, there's a capacity that we're trying to develop to deepen that understanding, and that's the capacity to stay focused or stay centered or stay composed. Various ways you might think about that. And so it's important to train in that. Now, many contemplatives, what they try to do is they try to develop modes of collectedness, ways of collectedness that are constant. They might use, many of you might use a gatha, a little phrase. Infinite patience, boundless compassion. Infinite patience, boundless compassion. Infinite patience, boundless compassion. So you pick up just a little phrase like that, right? as a kind of reminder, like a touchstone. And you begin to introduce it into your consciousness and use it all the time. You might train with that, like during a meditation, but then you bring it into the committee meeting, into the bus, and there are no more buses in Ottawa, into the parking lot, into the marketplace. Infinite patience, balanced compassion. Now, if that was a kind of reminder of what is the composed mind, if that was a link to that, if that was that idea of link is quite good, then you'd be reminded of that. And then as the mind was beginning to get upset or uptight, infinite patience, boundless compassion, the mind would be more attentive to why that's happening. You'd be able to investigate the contraction more. You'd see, well, that's not it. You know, this my mind kind of flying off now. There's something not right here. Whereas a mind which has no strength, which has no composure, which has no centeredness, or that doesn't do any training in it, usually is just a very reactive mind. When it's sunny, the person's happy, and when it's cloudy, the person gets depressed, kind of thing. So it's like a leaf in the wind. Just get blown around by any old mood, one mood, another mood, and so on. So the training that we try to do in meditation is very humble, actually. I mean, some of the states of mind that one reads about are very exalted, and that's all well and good. But just the kind of humble experience of just totally accepting one out breath, or just being with like a gata, infinite patience, boundless compassion. It's like using two words: in breath, out breath, infinite patience. Balance, compassion. Now, if you're asleep, you'll probably fall asleep with that one. Something more vigorous. But what we do with these simple trainings is we both learn about a collected mind, and we also develop the capacity to remember a collected mind. And we have memory. We have the capacity to evoke things. We have memories which are simply triggered, but also we have the capacity to bring forth. So my mind can be triggered by, like, if I get really stressed out by something, something can be triggered in me, some emotion which is very, very uptight, right? Because of the conditions are there. So there's that kind of memory which is simply called forth because of circumstances. But I can also train the mind and evoke states of peace or calm or openness or compassion quite deliberately. I can do that quite deliberately. I can remember someone I respect or love, and I can evoke that feeling in the heart. Now that deliberate act is the kind of training we do. So when I deliberately, like, learn to compose the mind. And I'm very conscious about that. And I see myself doing that, and I see the results of that. That sets in mind a kind of understanding. Yeah, okay, that's what it's about. And then I remember how to do that, and the more I remember how to do that, I do that. And the more I do that, the more I remember how to do that. One helps the other. Yeah. Vice versa, if a person, if I feel, if something triggered in me, which is, let's say I feel annoyed at someone, right? And I'm not attentive to that annoyance, and I don't see it as a contraction, and I believe in it, then I act through it. I either think or I project onto the people around me, and I believe in those perceptions. I become annoyed. Now, that then becomes food for more annoyance and triggers for more annoyance. So the annoyance feeds itself, doesn't it? It's a kind of vicious cycle. The more I feel annoyed, the more my triggers of annoyance get triggered, and it just goes on and on and on. It's a vicious cycle. But in equally true, the more I get a sense of composure, the more I recognize that as wholesome, the more I make intentions, yeah, I'm going to try to train in that, the more I'll remember to do that, and the more I remember to do that, the more strong it'll get. And the more strong it gets, the more I remember to do that. So we as we train our minds, we have these choices. If we are heedless, of course, we are first of all taken by old habits, and then we reinforce old habits. And vice versa, when we train the mind quite deliberately in this way, we remember or we notice new things maybe, and then we remember to do those things, and they become more part of our natural being. So training the mind has both aspects of the wholesome and the unwholesome. It has both aspects of abandoning that unskillful part and developing and strengthening that skillful part. Now, if I understand that and I see that in the various ways my mind works, because this is very personal, I'll get general ideas from teachers and texts and those kinds of instructions, but the particular avenues that my mind suffers through on goes down, right? The particular kind of things that get up my nose, that irritate me, that frighten me, that obsess me, those I have to awaken to, I have to inquire about, and I have to learn how to somehow not believe in them. And I have to develop the strengths that I don't get overwhelmed by them. Now, sometimes in meditation we'll get very exalted kinds of experiences, as I was saying. You may get fantastic feelings of compassion or deep sense of peace and so on. And they're all wonderful because they're good signs in the practice. But our practice is not to get anything very, very special, but it's to bring our minds back to the very ordinary and to an acceptance of the ordinary. So the language we're always using is, this is the way it is now. Now that's a profound thing to remember. Why is it profound to remember? Because we tend to get grabbed so much. And if I'm obsessed by something, some worry or whatever, and I can remember, yeah, and this is worry. That's quite profound. It's not an exalted experience, but it is a liberating perspective. It is a liberating perspective because now I have some distance. I'm no longer the subject of that obsession. I have become the witness to a habit. And that's the only way freedom can take place, from that ordinary and yet profound position of knowing the way things are. And so That's the base kind of practice we're always recommending. And anything you can develop in your life which reminds you of that, and anything consistent you can develop which reminds you of that, it can be very, very powerful. So it might be, you might be a person who it feels that like body awareness is very helpful, and you might just choose your belly and the out-breath, something simple like that. And you'd really learn, put a lot of attention into the belly. And then do that a lot when you're in meditation, when life isn't too complicated. Then when life became complicated, and you know there was a lot of stuff coming at you, what you would have conditioned into your psyche was an awareness of your belly. It would be there. It would be a kind of secondary thing. And you'd have a capacity to not only deal with the complexity, but also to see, wow, this is really getting uptight, and to relax and to relax into belly. Why? Because you've trained the mind to do that. You've trained consciousness to be a certain way. If there's no training in consciousness, then it just goes the ways of reactive habit. And this kind of personalization of your practice, I think, is very helpful to find something that kind of works for you or is intuitively connects with you, and then to really hone that, to really work with that and make that a foundation for the simple statement, this is the way it is now. It feels this way now. So it's like a touchstone or like a catch that reminds you. So say like Ajahn Sumedho, he uses the sound of silence. I was listening to a talk of his where he's going through Heathrow Airport. And, you know, if you've been in Heathrow, it is a zoo. It's a terrible airport. I mean, it's over the top. But anyway, he's just going through sound of silence. Very peaceful. And so he's developed one thing very, very strongly where he can turn to it. He's still got his passport stamped. It's not like he kind of ran into a wall or anything. But he can still function, but he's got some kind of a centering. He kind of a centering that reminds him of the stillness of knowing. So it could be anything. It could be like gata, could be breath, it could be heart chakra. Heart chakras are very good. But it is something in terms of what we call sama samadhi, of developing that focus and composure of mind, that is a good thing to contemplate. Is there one thing in my practice that appeals to me, that draws me? And then to say, okay, that draws me, why don't I deepen that through my sitting practice, and why don't I try to deepen that in ordinary life? This is very fruitful, very, very helpful. What we do need for sure, whether we don't have a kind of particular thing, we need to remember the way things are. We need to come back to that simple, collected state of mind. Now, the beauty of, like, on Thursday I had this fantastic dream. Oh, just one of those dreams that you wake up and you're really happy. It's just, ooh. It was probably my mother, but it was my mother as guru, as like great compassionate guru, because the face was sort of in the dream, the face was kind of funny and I didn't recognize it, and it turned to me and there was an Indian woman, an older woman who was like Mataji, right? And it's just radiant with compassion. Oh, wake up. Mom, what would you like? But it changed. So that kind of experience is fine, and one is grateful for it because it's a good sign that something's right, something's working, but it's not reliable. So without dismissing the beauty of experiences in meditation and so on, what is reliable? And what is reliable is awareness. This is where we put our trust in. And then the more we can be appreciative of beautiful experiences, but also we can appreciate that the next day something completely horrible might get triggered in my consciousness. Some terrible memory of a time I got burnt out or whatever, and that's all right too. Because why? We're not taking a position with any object or with any experience, or that anything changes, we're taking refuge in knowing. the way things are. And the more and that insight, I think, and that understanding, and then the intentions based on that and the efforts based on that leads to a very good result, because it brings you back to your real home. Whereas if my understanding or my viewpoint of spiritual life was to always have such an exalted morning, right? There's just no way, because I won't have such an exalted, I didn't this morning. It's only like 2 days later. I didn't have a bad morning. But if I think that the spiritual life is the acquisition or the attainment of some exalted state which I remember, or which I have read about, or which someone has said I should get, then what happens to me? Then this present moment is this way. There is the memory or the suggestion or the reading, and this present moment then is inadequate. It's not good enough, and I have to get that other moment, that other thing, even if I've never experienced it, someone's just persuaded me into it. And then right there, that's suffering. Right there, that's suffering. But if I don't know that, if I've not, I don't awaken to suffering, and then I start to pursue this goal which comes from memory or suggestion, and I don't see that, then I just keep perpetuating suffering. Whereas if I'm constantly attentive to contraction, I'm constantly attentive to the ways of suffering of the heart, I'll see that even that seeking of a refined goal, which might be good, you know, it's not bad, it's not like robbing a bank or something, but that very seeking and looking for something in the future is the problem. That's the problem. Because it's a contraction, you feel it. That's the problem. So I come back to acceptance. Now, what do I have to accept? Well, maybe the reason I want that other thing is because my heart's quite annoyed at something. And then, yeah, but what does annoyance feel like? I come back to that basic practice. And then what happens? That sense of awareness becomes more powerful than annoyance. And the annoyance is simply a movement. It's not who I am. It's not my real, and I don't have to analyze it, and I don't have to get rid of it. Just be the witness. And this is different than trying to become someone who doesn't have annoyance. The annoyance runs its course. But what would make, say in this case, what would make that capacity to notice annoyance, what would make it more, how could I develop, what factors would I need to develop to make mindfulness stronger? What would I need to do? And these are the kind of questions we need to ask ourselves. Well, what would really make it powerful is if I knew how to evoke compassion and kindness. So on one hand, I have the annoyance, I have to learn how to accept it, and I have to learn not to indulge in it and not to run with it. And yet, on the other hand, I have this capacity to evoke something very wholesome and very good. And where do they come together? In repression? Because that was the person's kind of question. No, it's that sometimes the negative energies have a lot of power, and you just have to ride them out. Just be very patient. But sometimes they have no power. They're just like I like to say, they're just old gas, karmic gas, coming out of your mind. Wind. And so there, it's actually, don't even go there. You can shift your attention to something quite wholesome. So some of the things we try to do in our meditation practice is then deliberately evoke balancing energy. So to spend a half hour bringing up a sense of compassion and really getting in touch, what does that feel like? And doing that as a practice, and like evoking an image of someone who, when you think of them, opens your heart. So I think of my mother, and I think of my friends and so on, and I keep evoking that. That's quite deliberate. But that's not trying to get rid of annoyance. It's just doing it when it's appropriate. Then when annoyance arises, what have I got? I've got first of all, I have more strength of presence. And then I also have this power in consciousness which is about the heart being open. Then as the heart gets contracted, I notice that more quickly. I said, well, that certainly doesn't feel like compassion. And the annoyance becomes more obvious. I see it more clearly. Why? Because I've put these other energies into consciousness. I've put in compassion. I've put in a sense of presence. I've learned how to compose the mind. Then those really challenging energies, which might have obsessed me or got me caught up, I begin to, they still afflict me, right? They still come into the heart, but they're just known more clearly. Oh, that's what it feels like. It's annoyance. And then the temptation to follow them or believe in them or hate oneself for them. No, it just feels that way. So you get the power of presence and the power of compassion and can accept something like that into the mind. But if you don't have that, then the annoyance seems very real. You know, it can seem very, very real. The practices of the heart, we talk about the Brahma Viharas in our tradition, and metta, a practice of loving kindness. Lately, I much prefer the sort of the ideas of the golden rule. The word loving kindness it implies a lot. Love itself implies a lot in the English language. It's such a broad word which has so many meanings. I love potato chips and I love my mom. So what is it? But the golden rule, if you think about that, do unto others as you would have done unto you. Don't do unto others as you would not have done unto you. Let's say if someone insults me and they, you know, they just kind of go for me, insult me. And when I feel that, it's not pleasant. Now, the golden rule would be, what would that mean? It would mean, well, I don't like this. I'm not going to dump on other people. I don't like this feeling. I don't want other people to have that feeling. And that's not a requirement that I love anyone. It's just looking at other people in the way that I look at myself. If I, like, have you ever made a mistake? Have you ever purchased something that's really stupid? Have you ever been in a mood and said things you regret? Should I go on?
No.
So, if all of us have done that, why hasn't everyone else has been there too, right? So when someone says something to you stupid, and they're, you know, they're in a foul mood, and they call you a turkey or whatever, now socially you say, no, I'm Ajahn Dham, we're not a turkey. You can do that. But emotionally, I can take it personally. I can, you know, feel hurt and so on and say, well, I can say, first of all, I'm not going to do that to others, but I've actually done it to others. So there's forgiveness. You know, I can put myself in someone else's shoes because I've been there. Right? Whereas what we quite often do is when we make a mistake, we get into self-disparagement. Oh, I'm a terrible, terrible person, and so on. But maybe life is that we all make mistakes and we all make stupid purchases. Maybe life is that way. And then that terrible kind of alienation we have with others and always judging them as being, you know, inadequate and stupid and they should have done this and so on. We say, well, actually, it was a pretty dumb thing there. I did it myself. Especially like if you're in a mood, right? Have you ever been in a mood? and then you say something, right, in that mood, and then you walk away from, oh no, you know, so you can't take it back. Maybe you do a mea culpa and, you know, I apologize and so on. But you can also reflect that, yeah, but that's very human to do that. And that, as you accept that in yourself, rather than go into the litany of self-disparagement, then you tend to accept that in others. And so the heart begins to have not only a sense of openness from the kind of sign of metta, but also much more equanimity. It has a much more evenness of mind. And these ways of the heart are a way of developing awareness where the emotional contractions with it we experience are very much in our bellies, in our hearts. And the more we become attentive to that, and what does it feel like when the heart is open? When you when you relate to something in a connected way rather than a contracted way, an alienated way, what does that feel like? And you make a note of that, and you train in that. You get to know that. Then that's an aspect of samadhi. That's an aspect of the mind being open and composed, collected. So then when the other comes, the contraction, you begin to really, you see it before it even goes off into thought. They did some whatever they're called, the guys that do the brains. They did some experiments on fear, and through the kind of MRI scans, they created an image for a person to look at, the image of a bear, say, and the image then was received by the person. And then the mind created a story around it. Bear, be careful, fear. But before the thinking mind created a story around it, the impulse went to the amygdala in the middle of the brain, and there was fear. And then the fear conditioned the thinking. So the body was the first, and then the bodily reaction, the amygdala, the reptilian fearful bear, said, "You better be afraid, that's a bear." Rather than interpreting, that's a bear, I better be afraid. Our bodies, you know, we register these things very, very strongly. Now, if you are aware of at that body level, right, and you're aware of what compassion is at the bodily level, right? Then as you relate to life, as you walk around in life, you'll be very quickly aware of how you're cutting off from life, either from fear or aversion or greed or whatever it is. Your awareness will be a bodily based awareness. It won't be just a lot of analysis and thinking. That's very helpful. It's very quick, very fast, very immediate, and it's not mediated by a whole lot of I shouldn't have done this and I shouldn't have done that and I shouldn't. It's very, very, very present, very, very bodily oriented. And in the same way, the kind of like the negative emotions we feel, like anger. Have you ever noticed when you were in that mood that you might get a memory of something? Let's say you've had some altercation at the shops, and you're washing dishes or something, and that memory comes up, and you're feeling kind of negative about that, and then your partner says something, and that negative mood goes to them. They have nothing to do with it. That's the way moods work. They're just there, and then if we're not attentive, they govern our acts, they govern our speech, and we say things. Huh? So to be attentive of the moods of the mind on a very visceral way, I think, is very, very helpful, not simply through the thinking mind, and that kind of knowledge of the body and knowledge of your energy centers and heart centers is a kind of knowledge which it's a viewpoint which doesn't fool you. Like you know when your heart's open, right? You just know. You know when your heart's contracted, no matter what rationalization you put on it. But when you start rationalizing and so on, you can kind of really complicate it. So if I'm in a very, very negative mood, or if there's a very negative mood in the heart, put that better. And just to be aware of that, and then to make intentions, be careful. Be careful of speech. Don't believe it. Don't let it go to self. Don't create thought around it. Feel your out-breath, whatever language you want to use. Then you're making decisions and choices based on understanding, and decisions and choices which will be the causes for future peace. You may not feel peaceful right now, but you're the witness now, and you're making practice with something that habitually might have just driven you to do things. Well, sometimes if you just handle all this with like too much thinking and analyzing, what happens is that we're in the same soup all the time. We're kind of arguing with ourselves that I shouldn't feel this way. Yeah, but that wasn't, it shouldn't have done that to me. Yeah, but you shouldn't feel this way. Yeah, but they did that to me. And it's the same mood. It's the same mood. There's no distance. There's no space. There's no real, this is the way it is now. There's no center. But if that is the kind of primary practice that we use, this is the way it is now. And then we know ourselves. Is this skillful or unskillful? Is this something that is worthy of attention? Is this a place I want to get reborn into, or whatever it is, whatever language you want to use? And then making choices, making skillful choices, and they're just little choices. The choice to collect your mind in a meditation is a small choice. And we can all do that, can't we? You sit down and say, okay, how do I feel? Let me this way. It's a small step, but you might have to do it a million times in 45 minutes. You have to keep collecting. So it takes a lot of patience, but that builds a kind of strength. And then that strength takes you, governs your life more and more, rather than being governed by the various moods of the mind, which are just conditioned by other things. This leads to confidence. This kind of leads to an interest in the spiritual life, a kind of confidence. Yeah, this I can do this. I can make those little steps. But if I'm trying to somehow, be a different person suddenly, oh, I shouldn't feel angry or get some exalted state which I had, then it feels so hopeless sometimes. It seems very hopeless. But just to awaken is not that, that's not that difficult. The mood of the mind might be difficult. If you're really frightened by something, and that might be difficult to work through. It might take me a few days. But to awake and say, oh, wow, this is fear, it's quite possible. And it's a simple but profound thing to do. And ultimately, that really is where liberation lies. In that very, very simple step again and again and again. All right? So I'll leave that for your reflection.
And my young Dhamma Vargataya Sadhu Karang Dhamma.